Hello, and welcome to Encircled, the Halber Pocket Podcast. Episode 14, the 2nd of May to the 7th of May. The link-up between the 9th and the 12th armies was a tremendous success from a military point of view, and it represented a significant humanitarian achievement as well. But it also proved to be the watermark for the 9th army, as from the moment they linked up with the 12th Army, they ceased to operate as an independent fighting force. Few had come through their ordeal unscathed. Most of the soldiers were either walking wounded or suffering from serious injuries. And everyone in the 9th Army had been crippled by hunger and physical exhaustion, not to mention the severe mental strain they must have also endured. Given the wretched state of the 9th Army, Buss's forces were immediately amalgamated into Wenck's 12th Army, and it's highly doubtful that any of them took part in any further fighting. However, the ordeal wasn't quite over for the shattered remnants of the 9th Army, as they, along with the Potsdam garrison and the rest of the 12th Army, would now have to reach the banks of the Elbe, where they hoped to surrender to the US 9th Army stationed in Tangermünde. This journey measured an approximate 85 kilometers from where the 9th and 12th armies had met, and there were still numerous Soviet armies in the vicinity which threatened to block their escape route west. To make matters worse, Wenck wasn't even sure how to make the crossing over the Elbe to the American side, as only a few weeks prior, in mid-April, the 12th Army had in fact blown up the main road bridge over the Elbe in order to slow down the advance of the Americans. Back in the high days of mid-April, the Americans had been the main concern. In early May, however, the 12th Army had much bigger Soviet fish to fry. Nevertheless, as soon as the 9th Army survivors had been loaded into the waiting transports, Wenck started withdrawing his 12th Army divisions from the front lines and immediately set off for the west. The 12th Army was now in a race against time to reach the Elbe before the Soviets could cut them off. As part of the original plans for the assault on Berlin, Sukhov and Konev had been given the task of routing the German army, taking Berlin, and then driving all of the way to the Elbe to meet up with American forces coming from the west. So now that the fighting in Berlin was over, these Soviet fronts had a free hand to proceed west. And by the 2nd of May, multiple Soviet armies were positioned west of the city, and they were ready and waiting to make the final push on towards the Elbe. The 61st Army had reached Havelberg in northeast Saxon-Anhalt. The 47th Army, meanwhile, was positioned in Rathenau in western Brandenburg. And the 3rd Army was in the town of Brandenburg an der Havel itself. If this wasn't enough, the 33rd Army had reached Kropstedt in southeast Saxon-Anhalt. The 69th Army was in Niemek in southwest Brandenburg, and there was even the 1st Polish Army coming up from the south. All of these forces threatened Wenck's escape to the west. When Wenck's forces set off on the 2nd of May, it was estimated that over 100,000 soldiers, along with a similar number of refugees, were now on the move towards the Elbe. At this stage in the war, any notion of loyalty to the German High Command had completely evaporated. All these people cared about was escaping the clutches of the Soviets and reaching the freedom and safety they imagined the West would give them. And when news came through on the 3rd of May that Hitler had committed suicide in his bunker, the troops knew the war was finally over. Given his disdain of the German leadership in the dying days of the war, Wenck wasted no time in immediately reinstating the traditional military salute amongst his forces. In doing so, he abandoned the Nazi salute, which had been made mandatory for all officers in the Wehrmacht following the failed Stauffenberg bomb plot in July 1944. But whilst the 12th Army was trying to maintain some semblance of military honour, as they marched across the countryside, they saw firsthand how Germany had gone to the dogs. For example, when they passed through the town of Genten, some of the men saw that the canal was full of empty bottles of schnapps. This showed how in the dying days of the Reich, Wehrmacht soldiers had taken to looting shops and businesses to find ways to get themselves blackout drunk rather than face the shame of defeat. The once mighty Wehrmacht was now a shambolic mess. The 12th Army fought a fighting retreat all the way back to the Elbe, where a defensive perimeter had to be established on the eastern banks of the river. This perimeter could then be used as an evacuation ground for soldiers and refugees to cross the river and reach American lines. To lay down the groundwork for the evacuation, Wenck ordered one of his corps commanders, General Baron von Edelsheim, to cross the river in advance and start surrender negotiations with the US 9th Army. Wenck hoped that these negotiations would ease the evacuation of his army and the refugees once they arrived. On the 3rd of May, General Edelsheim crossed the river close to Tangermünde, and he made contact with the local American commander. The next day, official surrender negotiations took place in the town hall of the nearby town of Stendal. The lead US representative during these negotiations, General William Simpson of the US 9th Army, was not in an enviable position, however, for he had to walk a very fine diplomatic line. On the one hand, accepting the German surrender and thus preventing any further bloodshed was a no-brainer. On the other hand, however, Simpson wanted to avoid pissing off the Russians, from whom the 12th Army was clearly running away from. For the Soviets saw it as a matter of honour that they defeat the 12th Army and that they accept its surrender, not the Americans. Moreover, whilst General Simpson clearly understood the humanitarian need to feed the refugees and soldiers who wanted to come across, the actual logistics of feeding and housing so many people was immense. Simpson therefore decided to accept the surrender of any wounded and unarmed soldiers, but he refused to accept any civilian refugees. The official position being that the civilians would be made to return home anyway once the war officially ended. Simpson also refused Edelheim's offer of assistance to repair the bridges over the Elbe, which would have made the evacuation effort much easier. Lastly, he informed Edelsheim that the Americans would take no legal or moral responsibility for the actions of the Soviet forces across the river, and that if Wenck's army was cut off by the Soviets, then this would be their problem to deal with, not the Americans. And to really rub salt in the wounds, Edelsheim was also told that the Germans would have to provide the means for crossing the river themselves. In no position to argue, Edelsheim accepted the terms. The 12th Army arrived on the eastern banks of the Elbe late on the 4th of May, and by first light the next morning, they began crossing the river. In order to get as many people across as possible, three separate crossing points were chosen. In the north, one crossing point was established at the very damaged railway bridge between Stendal on the western side of the Elbe and Schönhausen on the eastern side. In fact, Schönhausen was where Wenck would have his headquarters during the evacuation. The second crossing point was established at the road bridge over the Elbe at Tangermünde, and it was this road bridge which had been blown up by the 12th Army earlier in April. All that remained of the bridge was half-twisted, mostly collapsed structures. I say mostly because actually some of the wooden planks connecting the bridge ramparts were still standing, which allowed some foot traffic to pass over. The last crossing point was established using the ferry crossing at the village of Fährschland, 12 kilometres to the south. All three of these crossings would see desperate scenes over the next few days. The survivors of the 9th Army, who had been to hell and back over the past 2 weeks, were given first priority to cross. This was partially done for humanitarian reasons, given their exhausted state. But it was also probably done for military reasons as well, given their inability to fight. And the remainder of the 12th Army would indeed have to fight hard during the evacuation. Their task was to defend the evacuation pocket itself, which stretched for 25 kilometres along the banks of the Elbe and ran 18 kilometres deep in the centre. The 9th Army knew what it was like to live under Soviet bombardment within a densely packed pocket, but this was a new experience for the 12th Army. As soon as the evacuation area was established, it came under heavy bombardment, as the surrounding Soviet forces poured wave after wave of artillery fire onto the soldiers and civilians alike. The 12th Army had marched halfway across eastern Germany to rescue the 9th Army, and in doing so, they had also rescued thousands of civilians. But whilst they were immensely proud of what they had achieved, The next few days on the Elbe would prove incredibly straining for them. Because adding to the physical danger they were in, they also became increasingly frustrated with the politics of the situation, which threatened to derail the evacuation entirely. Yes, the Germans were terrified at the prospect of falling into Soviet hands, but they also became exasperated with the Americans, who stubbornly refused to assist in the evacuation effort. Moreover, even when they made it across the river, the Americans seemed to spend an excessive amount of time checking and filtering out the soldiers, taking great care to separate Wehrmacht personnel from SS personnel and foreigners from Germans. American soldiers were happy to relieve any German soldiers of their weapons, medals, and watches. To the victors go the spoils. Some German soldiers tried to smuggle civilian women over to the American side by dressing them up in long grey Wehrmacht coats, but most were discovered and removed from the queue. Within the groups of soldiers attempting to cross, there were also many heavies in the ranks. Soviet prisoners of war who had turned against the Soviets and volunteered to fight in the German forces instead. The heavies rightfully feared Soviet retribution if they were to be captured by the advancing Red Army, and it's estimated that up to 5,000 of the heavies originally serving in the Ninth Army had survived the fighting to reach the Elbe. SS soldiers were under the belief that the Americans would hand them straight back to the advancing Soviets if they tried to cross, so they quickly burned their ID papers and changed into regular Wehrmacht uniforms, whilst foreign volunteers in the SS tried to pass themselves off as forced foreign labourers. By the 6th of May, the evacuation bridgehead was only 8 kilometres wide and 2 kilometres deep, and the divisions defending the perimeter were almost out of ammunition. But as valiantly as these divisions fought, the Soviets could still easily rain Katyusha rockets, artillery, tank and mortar fire onto the evacuation area, and thus thousands of people were killed whilst waiting to cross. The movement of people across the main road bridge proceeded at a snail's pace, because the evacuees could only move single file across a solitary plank still connecting the two halves of the bridge. If too many people attempted to walk this plank at the same time, it might collapse, stranding everyone else waiting to cross. But desperate times call for desperate measures, so of course, not everyone waited to go patiently over the bridge in single file. In their desperation, many groups would cross the river in whatever type of craft they could find, including boats, canoes, and skiffs. In other cases, makeshift rafts would be fashioned from planks of wood or empty drums of fuel tied together with string. Ideally, once a craft had made the crossing, they would then come back to pick up another group. But few people did this. Heinz Küster was an aircrew candidate who was drafted to fight in a parachute convalescent battalion in the defense of Brandenburg. Here, he describes the scene on the east bank of the Elbe on the afternoon of the 6th of May. The Elbe was in full flood and dangerous, sweeping everything along in its depths. Opposite us, the river formed a big bend and was about 350 meters wide. About 250,000 to 300,000 soldiers and a vast number of refugees were on the meadows between the Elbe dike and the river. I reckon there was also some 2,000 to 3,000 horses. As time went by, the Russians increased their pressure, firing indiscriminately with mortars, field, and anti-tank guns. There must have also been some large caliber tank guns, for horses and people were being blown apart. Panic caught hold, and there were screams from the wounded and from the men and animals being torn apart. It was hell. The cries of fear from the horses were frightful. Thousands of people were torn away that afternoon and night by the racing, swirling river. We could hear the endless cries for help and see the raised arms of those trying to swim across the Elbe. At about 4 in the afternoon, an inflatable boat came across from the American side. Everyone streamed down to the riverbank and the boat was overloaded. But no one wanted to sit on the side and take a paddle. I took my Luftwaffe comrade by the collar and pulled him onto the boat, then jumped on the side and took a paddle. A sergeant major with a drawn pistol shouted that he was in command of the boat. With steely gestures and a loud voice, he made it clear that he would shoot anyone without pity who did not follow his instruction to the letter. Then he demonstrated how to use the paddles and handed out 8 of them. We would have to paddle with all our strength, or we would never reach the other side, and the Russians would shoot us down like rabbits. This was my last chance, and I paddled like a world champion. The Russians fired at us in the middle of the river, but about 10 to 20 meters too short. Incredibly, we got across untouched. There were 48 men in the boat and 8 paddling. The water level was only 5 centimeters below the boat casing. The sergeant major said he would row back again and wanted us to row back with him. But the 64-year-old NCO and myself took off. We were both soaked through to the skin and freezing in the ice-cold wind. The sun peeked through the clouds from time to time, but we were freezing. The Soviet fire grew so intense that the American soldiers trying to filter the refugees crossing the bridge were now in danger of being hit by Soviet artillery. This danger was compounded when Soviet tanks broke through the German evacuation perimeter and started firing directly onto the road bridge crossing point. The US forces fired flares to signal their positions to the Soviets. But in the intensity of the crossfire, 3 American soldiers were wounded and 1 was killed. A further friendly fire incident happened at the ferry crossing point as well. Therefore, on the 6th of May, in response to the increasing danger to their own men, the US 9th Army ordered their soldiers to pull back by 2 kilometers from the banks of the Elbe. The withdrawal of the Americans presented a golden opportunity to the Germans, who now used this chance to swarm across the bridges and river crossings with as many people as possible, soldier or civilian. But even with the pullback of the Americans, the desperation of the Germans meant that people tried anything to escape, and more people took to swimming across the river. Some strong swimmers would swim across carrying a line or cable in their teeth, which would then be tied around a tree or a post on the western bank. Women, children, and weaker swimmers would then cross the river by holding onto this line. However, the river was in full flood, and often these cables would break, washing the civilians and soldiers downstream. Hundreds of people drowned. Such was the desperation of the Germans in these final few hours, there are reports that some people who were unable to cross the river chose to take their own lives instead, rather than surrender to the Soviets. By the afternoon of the 7th of May, the evacuation perimeter was in full collapse, with the 12th Army artillery units firing off their last precious rounds of ammunition. The guns were spiked, and the crews made a desperate break to the river. By the evening, the evacuation was complete, with General Wenck being one of the last to cross. He had truly left it to the last moment to make his crossing, because when he did, Soviet troops fired upon his boat, wounding 2 NCOs, 1 fatally. Just as with the escape of the 9th Army from the Halber Pocket, it is difficult to get an accurate count of the numbers of soldiers and civilians who escaped across the Elbe. General Wenck reported that 100,000 soldiers and 300,000 civilians had been evacuated. General Moore from the US 9th Army, however, estimated that 40,000 fighting troops, 25,000 unarmed soldiers, 6,000 wounded soldiers, and 100,000 civilians had made the crossing. Historians such as Cornelius Ryan estimated that at least 100,000 people had crossed the river, and that of the 9th Army's original total of 200,000 men, only 40,000 had survived. Whatever the true number, it's safe to say that many, many soldiers and refugees had made the crossing, while also many had lost their lives trying to escape. In any case, after reaching American lines, the ordeal for the 9th and 12th Armies was finally over.